How I became entrepreneur. At home, I found numerous prospects of Keats AS. I correctly sensed that in that vast empire of enormous machine might there will be some appropriate dwarf who will save me. I found him in the Keats catalogue. It was a punching apparatus which increased workers' productivity many times over and assured the fulfillment of orders on time. I myself had learned to control the steel dwarfs perfectly, and I also taught the others. I supplied them with appropriate work organization, and with the help of additional minor technical improvements, I expanded the production, which by its quality and cost surpassed even the large factories organized to produce the same with larger capital. Our books soon showed rapidly growing side of assets and equally rapidly declining side of liabilities. My wealth soon exceeded the amount necessary for buying that small farm, and certainly more than I needed for myself, or even for my brother and sister. As long as I was on the defensive against foreign capital, as long as I fought to defend the honor of myself, my brother, and my sister, as long as I worked to provide for the necessities of life, until then, all my work was justified by the moral values derived from and maintained by my immediate surroundings. Now I lost that firm grounding under my feet. It did not bother me during my work. After all, I did only what was desirable and necessary to other people. I provided them with the work they were seeking and which they urgently asked me. I sold only to those who wanted to buy and who expressed satisfaction with my products. It was quite different, however, when I took an hour off and went among the better people for a small talk, or if I opened a newspaper or picked up a book. From all sides and from all corners I was shouted at, "You leech! You slaver!" There was not yet my name associated with all this, but attacked there was the ideal which was starting to take shape in my mental shop. The ideal which was supposed to become a new moral foundation of my work, and which now had to struggle hard for its existence with its older brother socialist. My friends were apologizing for me, insisting that I do not belong in that evil society, because my production is very small. To me, it was like that they were simply saying that I am only lesser than the others. I did not wish to be a villain. I thought and read about cooperative enterprise, but I recall the experience with my brother when each and every work was talked over, but none was done. I saw everywhere the bad result of cooperatives, even of those consisting of which my brother did recognize this right. And how would the things go in some such cooperation, where all profits would have to be distributed among co-workers? How would we then buy that steam engine needed to utilize the help of those German and American giants of steel? There was no way out. I had to stay in my place and become that hated and loathed industrialist, leech and slaver, in order to serve the people. After such decisive victory, the steam engine of 8 HP soon came, together with the steel helpers. The first real factory building also came, together with my father's foreseen smokestack, even though only metal plate one. In 1904, there were already 3 smokestacks smoking. We were buying small, older steam engines which did not work well, and there was always the need to obtain new, better power sources, NAD new, larger factory building, together with additional specialized machinery. I did not trust my knowledge, acquired through work and travels in Europe, to start so many new ventures with confidence. In that same year, I left for America, accompanied by 3 young workers. There I found many beautiful things, but most of all I liked the people. They did not wallow in prejudices about honor or dishonor of work. Such questions were resolved by their grandfathers long time ago. Selling newspapers in the street was good enough and acceptable for the son of high official, son of millionaire, or son of worker. There were no students, gentlemen. You could only see rolled-up sleeves and a joyful work. A 6-year-old boy appeared big enough to his father as to be allowed to create his own possessions and to make his own decisions about it. Son was being led towards independence. He was not to feel his father's dominance. He was to become an equal citizen. I am businessman. You are businessman. Our skills are recognized by how much each of us earns. Father's eyes brighten when hearing about his son's new dollar. Son is proud of his father and each of his new successes. Such attitudes are then transported from the family to the public. Mr. Miles showed me the factory of his competitor and said, "Can you imagine how capable that man must be if he can earn enough to pay $1 million of income tax?" Interesting was that this Mr. Miles himself earned less than nothing, having increasedly more debts than assets. Nevertheless, he was very proud of his more skillful competitor. The soul of American man was not shackled by doubts whether or not an individual man can amass wealth. Such doubts were very much alive in the subconsciousness of our own society, thanks to old Slavonic law, which was replaced only by force by Roman law. According to the Slavonic law, all community members brought and collected the fruits of their work in one barn. The products were then distributed among community members by the chief, according to his conscience and best judgment of need, not according to individual labor and merit. This was the old family socialism. Subconscious reverence for Slavonic law has been kept alive in the Russian literature, especially by Tolstoy. This also provided very fertile soil for the new socialism of Marx, which is essentially the same idea, but extended to the whole of society. Concerning machines and work organization, I did not find much new in America. This was to be expected with respect to machines, because for a long time I maintained active correspondence with local machine factories. In the organization of machinery, only the layout was of interest. I was changing my layouts several times a year, and finally invented the pattern which even in America they considered to be best. But the skills of workers were great. On some machines, they were achieving 10 times higher performance than our own workers. Therefore, I worked there as a factory worker, knowing fully that it is futile to tell people how to work and not being able to show them. I also wanted to experience with my own body the difficulties in attaining such high performances. From home, I brought a high regard for my own skills. I was convinced that I could work skillfully on all shoemaking machines, but in America this self-confidence brought much harm upon me. When asked what work I can do, I answered proudly that all and every work. The factory receiver only smiled and said, "Not needed," an answer I could not understand and explain for a long time. Finally, I managed to advance so far as to be put on the line of job applicants and tested in one kind of work. I finally understood the legitimacy of receiver's contemptuous smile. I realized that in my lifetime I could not master all work to such perfection of performance as it was then normally required in America. For some time, I worked under the patronage of my landlord Berka in one bad factory in Linn. I wanted to stand up on my own feet. The work was hard to find. Those who had work used to wake up before 7 in the morning. Those who did not have work had to wake up before 5 in order to stand before the gates of some remote factory well before the work started. So I felt fortunate to see myself with rolled-up sleeves. This coat of arms of American nobility, taking a test at one or the other machine. The foreman followed all my movements very intensely. I did not even have to look at his face in order to read my fate in it. I was told by the laughter of other applicants, waiting behind me with equally rolled up sleeves, waiting for me to fail. They did not have to wait long. Such tests I sometimes underwent about 20 a day, and 6 times as many in a week. My mind became depressed and dispirited. I was fully absorbed in thoughts and feelings of a worker. I did not care about the dollars imported from America. I wanted American dollars. I wanted to measure myself directly with American man. Once, on one such journey, I said to myself that I would not eat until I get a job. And I got it. From a rover and useless man, all of a sudden I became a nobleman. My hands were torn and bruised, but my head was sitting firmly in its place. With these personal notes ends Thomas Butter's own narrative about the beginnings of his work. The task will be finished, but the notes remained but a torso. In the second part, we shall continue by coherent and orderly publication of speeches, with the help of which Butter guided and built his work.